Do you ever feel like your body just doesn't work the way it's supposed to? Well, it turns out that there are actually a lot of flaws baked right into our DNA. From a biological perspective, we're a total mess. Our next guest is Nathan Lentz. He's a biologist. He hosts a podcast called This World of Humans, and he's just written a book about everything wrong with the human body. According to him, our entire evolutionary history has been a series of mistakes and adaptations to get around those mistakes. But even though our bodies are flawed, the fact that humans have been so successful in spite of these flaws is really the thing that sets us apart. Nathan's new book is called Human Errors, a panorama of our glitches from pointless bones to broken genes. And he's in the studio now to talk about it. Nathan, welcome to WNYC.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So we're all humans here, and we'd like to think that our species is pretty special. We're at the top of the food chain. We've created these great civilizations. Sometimes we fly to outer space. And when you take all of these achievements together, it might be easy to assume that as a species, we are evolutionary perfection, but we're not.
That's right. In fact, the thesis of my book really pushes back on two misconceptions. One is that humans are special and at the top of evolutionary ladder, so to speak. So human exceptionalism, I really push back on that. But the other idea that I push back on is that evolution can or ever could produce perfection. It really doesn't. Evolution does the best that it can with the bodies that we have and the time that we're living. And, you know, the environment is constantly changing. Our challenges are different from day to day and from year to year, certainly eon to eon. And so what you end up with is a sort of clumsy hodgepodge of adaptations, some of which are great and some of which are a little curious, we'll say.
So one of the first flaws you talk about is the human eye. So why do you think that the human eye is so poorly designed?
Well, there are a number of structural and functional problems with the human eye, such that an intelligent designer, so to speak, certainly wouldn't build it that way. And this is a good example for how I define the word flaw. Flaw doesn't mean that it doesn't work well, the way I define it. It's just that it doesn't quite make sense. It defies reason why it would be built in that way or work in that way. Except for, we know the reason. The reason is that it was an evolutionary past. It has a long evolutionary past. So if you take the eye, for example, the photoreceptor cells, which are in the back of your eye, in the retina, they face backwards. They really don't face forwards towards the light. Now, no engineer would design a microphone, you know, pointed the wrong way. That's the analogy I use in the book. But we have evolved. We have adapted to make pretty good use of the arrangement that we have. And there's little tricks that we have to make it well. But we would just never design it that way in the first place. And it does have costs. So retinal detachment is a problem that's probably almost exclusively due to this retina having to be much thicker than it need be in order to accommodate this backwards arrangement. And the body's filled with little quirks like that, that really, we've done a good job, but it really, if it were intelligently designed, it would be much more efficient and simple.
And so can we blame evolution for the fact that so many of us need glasses?
Yes and no. So the fact is, the majority of adults need lenses. I mean, I'm looking at you, and between
yes.
us, we have two pairs of corrective lenses. And in fact, in the Asian population, something like 75% of the adult population have myopia, which is nearsightedness. That one's not as simple as evolution. Evolutionary design. That's actually the result of our common living now indoors. So we spend most of our childhood indoors, and while the eye is still growing, and so we become nearsighted for that reason. If you look at hunter-gatherer populations, or even just populations where people spend more time outdoors, myopia is much, much lower, around 10%. But if you think about it, it's still a flaw, because why would it be so limited in its potential and its developmental potential? And then even 10% in hunter-gatherers is pretty high, because if you can imagine a bird of prey, you will never find one with poor vision, because if you lose your vision as a bird of prey, you'll starve almost immediately.
Right.
So the fact that our eyes can becomes so out of whack and yet we still thrive is actually, that's the key to the whole story of my book, is that we don't have to be perfect. We've developed these huge brains and this really intricate social structure, which has taken the pressure off of our body to perform optimally. You don't have to be good at anything. You don't have to be good at every single thing. You just have to get by, so to speak.
So let's talk about how we get by when we don't produce our own vitamin C. So other species do.
That's right. Most animals actually produce their own vitamin C, ascorbic acid, as it's called, in their liver cells. But we don't. In fact, no primates do. What happened was a gene called GULO, for short, was mutated in the ancestor of all primates. Just by chance, we're always getting mutated. These things are always happening. And it happened to inactivate this gene. And so that organism and all of her descendants are now dependent on vitamin C in their diet. But you might ask, why didn't she die right away of scurvy, of vitamin C deficiency? Well, the answer is that she was living in an area where there was plenty of citrus fruit or other sources of vitamin C in her diet. And so her body had no way to know. She wasn't deficient in vitamin C because of her diet. However, that has restricted primates. For 100 million years, primates have only been able to live where vitamin C is readily available. And there are large stretches of the world where vitamin C isn't commonly found. And Europe is a great example of this. No primates ever really successfully colonized Europe until humans. And we got scurvy when we did.
And so speaking of our diets, that's another flaw, isn't it? How our diets are so specific. It makes me think about how koalas literally eat a single type of leaf.
Mm-hmm.
The eucalyptus leaf until the day they die, while humans need to consume all these different types of food from different food groups to stay healthy.
That's right. We really need a little bit of this, a little bit of that. We need this rich, varied diet, whereas most animals don't. And you mean your dog, usually dog food's very simple,
right.
Lamb and rice, or that's a premium dog food, lamb and rice, and they'll be just fine their whole lives. They won't be deficient in anything. And again, the story there is that we've taken the pressure off of our body. And in terms of our diet, we were evolving in basically a salad bowl of rich, nutritious food of wide variety in sub-Saharan Africa. And that environment still is relatively rich in all kinds of nutrients. And so when our body sort of grew up, so to speak, it had all these things handed to it, served on a platter, literally, in some cases. And so we stopped making a lot of things for ourselves that most animals actually do.
I'm Cindy Rodriguez, and I'm speaking with biologist Nathan Lentz about his latest book, Human Errors. Now, let's talk about our throat. So one really obvious flaw that you point out, and that maybe we can all relate to, because I know a lot of times drink goes down the wrong pipe. So, and some people actually die from choking. So talk to us about the design of your throat and how it serves as a pathway for food, but also air.
Right. So there are some general problems with the throat and then also some specific one to our species. So let me begin with the general ones. Just the very concept of using the same tube for food and air is really silly. And it really has no real advantage to it. It's just a pure drawback. But evolution is sort of stuck with that. But there are other arrangements that are much better. I mean, dolphins, for example, and whales, they breathe out of a separate entry to their lungs, so they don't choke. There's no way they could choke. And if you look at both reptiles and birds, from their nostrils, they have a separate path to their lungs, so they can breathe while they're swallowing. So if you ever see a bird or a snake with a huge thing in its mouth, it's breathing just fine through its nose, even though it's mid-swallow, so to speak. So that's a much better arrangement, right? So that's one problem that we all have among mammals, at least the non-cetacean mammals. But another specific problem that humans have is that to make the sounds that we make with our throat, which is very unique, human speech, we have an anatomical arrangement in our mouth and throat that really allows us to do a lot with sound, making sounds. But the cost of that is we have an even smaller area from which to navigate swallowing. So food and water versus breathing. So we have this very, very tight space in which to do that. It's great for speaking, but choking is something that our close relatives really don't deal with nearly as often as we do.
Huh. And what about the common cold? You talk about another big flaw being our sinuses. Apparently they're so badly designed that we get 200 times more head colds than dogs, for instance.
Right.
What's wrong with our sinuses?
Right. So the what we think of as the common cold or a nasal sinus infection is an almost exclusively human problem. And what happens is we have these big nasal sinus cavities, or our maxillary sinuses, they're called, right behind our cheekbones. And I'm pointing at my cheeks right now. Well, the drain pipe for this cavity is in the top of the chamber, not the bottom where gravity would help, in the top. And so you're constantly producing mucus, which is a good thing. It traps invaders, it traps allergens, it traps dust, and then you send it backwards into your throat. Well, the problem is you have to work hard to push that mucus up to the top where the drainage pipe is, which happens also to be very skinny. So that's a separate problem, but not unrelated. So you have this skinny little drain pipe right at the top, and it just does not take very much for it to get gummed up and stuck, and then you get a festering pool of infection right in the bottom. And sometimes you can lay down and get a little bit of relief, but really, of all the primates, we have the worst arrangement here. And what happened was, early mammals had long snouts, like our reptile ancestors, and it gets smushed into the face, so we have a reduced snout because we use our eyes. We don't really use our sense of smell the way that most mammals do. We use our eyes, and we brought our eyes forward for binocular vision, etc. Well, the problem is we had to cram all of these cavities in, and we just sort of smushed it up in a very suboptimal way. And orangutans have better, chimpanzees have better, gorillas have better. They all have a better arrangement. They all have a funny arrangement because of what we had to do. But the thing is that you might wonder, well, why wasn't this fixed? Why did evolution allow this really poor drainage from the nasal sinuses? And the answer, which is the theme of the book, is, well, because you don't die from it very often. You don't die from a common cold, so you don't take those genes with you. So evolution does not shape us to be healthy, to be happy, to be comfortable. It doesn't care about any of that. It really just shapes us to survive and to reproduce.
So let's talk about autoimmune diseases that have become very common, like lupus and rheumatoid arthritis. How do these conditions relate back to the idea of genetic flaws in humans?
Right. Well, if you think of just the very concept of an autoimmune disease is a flaw in itself, because it's your immune system attacking itself, attacking your own body. And so you lose the ability at some point to discern your own tissues and your own proteins in some cases from invading ones. And so you mount this immune response. And the real flaw here is not just that you start the response, but the response becomes what we call feed forward. It just sort of like a runaway train, a chain reaction, until you get very ill. And so autoimmune diseases are one of the most frustrating diseases to deal with, because when you are attacking yourself, there can't be a winner in that fight, right? You can only lose. And so we try to tamp down the immune system with some drugs, but that just leaves you vulnerable to other kinds of infections. This is really a conundrum. And how it evolved is, no one's really sure how the diseases first came about. But one thing is clear is that our high population density seems to have done some funny things with our immune system. It made it hyperactive to deal with the increased allergens and infectious disease that we're all in close contact now, but we have the opposite problem. And I think we also make a mistake when we try to raise our children in these sterile environments and wash your hands and don't let them eat that and try to keep them as sterile as possible. That's really not the best way, because your immune system, like anything else, gets better with practice. So you need to see safe allergens, so they're not allergens if they do, but safe antigens, we'll say, safe environmental factors that you can tell the difference. So you learn to tell the difference between safe and unsafe, healthy and unhealthy. And when you don't do that, your immune system is just not as good as it could be.
And what about our bones and our skeletal system? This is something that you spend quite a bit of time on. Talk about some of the extra bones we have that we don't actually need.
Right. Well, we have, most of our joints are actually sort of quirky arrangements. Some are better than others, and this really goes back to our evolution to upright walking, so bipedalism, because we were mostly on all fours and living in the trees, and then we stood upright, and we did that in the evolutionary blink of an eye. We did it very, very quickly, and just like anything else, you do it quickly, you don't do it carefully, you don't do it well. And so our joints are sort of a hodgepodge.
Well, what is a blink of an eye? Can you give me?
Well, we're not even sure, actually, because in the fossil record, you sort of see it, you don't really see a lot of intermediary You really see arboreal, so tree dwellers, and then you see immediately next, you see individuals who can walk upright, although they were still arboreal. So they had an upright posture, but they hadn't completely left the forest for the grasslands yet. So they sort of border living probably. But you really don't see a lot of this intermediary because the intermediary was probably evolving very rapidly because halfway forms aren't very successful usually. And that's why we have a hard time catching these transitional fossils just because they didn't exist for very long. But evolutionary blink of an eye, certainly hundreds of thousands of years, not millions of years.
Okay.
And so you have this, and so you have the knees and the ankles. If you think of the ankles, there's something like 7 bones in the ankle itself. Then you have the five bones actually on the top of the foot, and then the 2 bones of the leg, and they all crash together in this one joint. Now think about how an engineer designs a robot. Okay. He or she would not use so many moving parts all in one in area sort of crashed in there.
There's a lot of room for error there.
There's a lot of room for error because every single point of attachment we have, tendons and ligaments, is a potential weakness. It's a potential place that can be pulled in a sprain or a strain.
Right.
And so a better ankle would have many fewer bones, and we sort of fuse some of them together. I mean, they're not really all sloshing around exactly, but if we could have them a fewer number and less moving parts, it would certainly be less prone to injury, we'll say.
Right,
and also
knees.
Greater mobility, too. Our ankles are not very mobile. The knees are another example where we have this little ligament right in the middle that bears most of the weight. And that's because when we were on all fours, you had 4 limbs and you could spread that weight out. But when you're up on 2, you've doubled the amount of weight and that ligament just didn't grow. It didn't respond. And so when you have to turn quickly or shift your weight, that little ligament can just snap.
And so hence now we have a society full of knee replacements.
Yeah. The ACL injury is the most common sports injury now, and it's only getting more common. And the reason for that is our bodies are getting bigger and bigger and bigger, especially among our athletes. And so you have massive momentum that suddenly switches, and that poor little ligament just can't take it. And there's no way to work it out to make it stronger either. It's just sort of there.
And it is what it is.
It is what it is. And when it tears, surgery is the only way to fix it. If you have ever had an ACL tear, before 100 years ago, you would have been a cripple for life. And I broke my ankle same way. I needed surgery. Without modern medicine, the gift of this big brain that we all have, I would never have walked again.
And we're back from the break. I'm Cindy Rodriguez, and I'm speaking with biologist Nathan Lentz about his latest book, Human Errors. So, Nathan, we were talking about knees. We were talking about ankles. I know that another big complaint that I hear from plenty of people is back problems. Everybody seems to have back problems. Is this also an evolutionary flaw?
Yes. Some of it I would rightly categorize as a design flaw, and other problems we have with our back is that we just don't use it as it was designed. So first, just let me make you feel a little worse and say that chimpanzees and gorillas never have a slip disc. A herniated disc is definitely a human problem.
Okay.
And that's the design flaw part, where we have these little pieces of cartilage in between each one of our vertebra, and they're not exactly in line with the vertebra for an upright posture. So they're thinking, so to speak, that the weight is borne more frontwards as if we were on all fours, and that's why they slip. So if they had been more in line, they wouldn't slip so often. So that's one problem we have
the
back. And that's really, you can just blame that on anatomy. But the other problem we have is that we don't actually use our back for the posture that it was designed for, even since walking upright. And what I mean by that is, you and I right now are doing something that is not in evolutionary concert with our body. We're sitting in a chair. Chairs were never part of our evolutionary past.
Really?
Never. So we've invented chairs and they feel nice and comfortable to us. But if you look at, say, hunter-gatherer tribes, they might sit on a stump for a little bit, but normally they spend their time squatting. Mm-hmm. Or even just laying down, relaxing, or leaning against a tree. They're up most of the time. And so, and that strengthens the core muscles of the back. They're called postural muscles. And when they're in a stronger arrangement, you won't get that weak lower back that causes a lot of back pain. So there are the good news, and my book, by the way, is full of lots of good news too, and we can talk about that. But the good news is that we can do something with that information. And there's been this proliferation of stand-up desks and even walking desks, and people who are having one-on-one meetings while walking through their office rather than sitting down. These are all good things you can do to keep your back strong. And I've done that myself. I made this transition about 2 years ago to a stand-up desk, and it's hard at first because your body wants to sit. But right. Once you get used to it, I haven't had back pain since. My back has been stronger than it's ever been by just doing nothing more than standing up instead of sitting.
Right. If you look outside the studio, you can see some people with, not many, but there's a few people who stand.
And the coworkers usually are giving them dirty looks. but as it becomes more normal, I think you'll see less back problems.
So why can't evolution just fix these flaws? Why is it that we're just stuck with them?
Well, so for a long time, let's start with the recent past. One thing is we fix them now medically, right? So we have this big brain that has figured out ways to go past these problems, fix them. And to a certain extent, we've escaped natural selection. Not evolution exactly, but we've definitely, most individuals that are alive, that are born, I should say, live to reproductive age. But this goes back much further even than you think, because it's not just about medical technology, it's about social structure and social support. We have been relying on each other for a very long time, and we found fossils from 2 million years ago of individuals who lived with horrible injuries for years, or who lost all their teeth but still lived for years. Mm-hmm. How did they do that? Except by their colleagues, their family, their friends caring for them and doing things for them, and even chewing their food for them in the case of the Dmanisi man who lost all his teeth. And that kind of social care is a big part of our evolution. It's a big reason why our bodies aren't perfect, because they didn't have to be. So you as an individual could provide value to your community in so many different ways. If you had great eyesight and great physical shape, you could be a hunter, but you could also be a homesteader. Right. And you could be a gatherer, or you could be a resource of social knowledge. Right. So your wisdom, you could be a shaman, you could be whatever. There were so many mm-hmm. different ways to be successful and to be valuable to the group and this is what I mean by my book is a happy story, really, because isn't it nice that we don't have to have perfect bodies in order to be contributing members of our group? And that history goes back pretty far. So I think it's a testament to our greatness that we have these flaws, and they didn't get eliminated through the, because natural selection, when we say eliminated natural selection, that means death. So it's good, I think, that people didn't die because their eyesight was poor.
Right. So the world is not as harsh as we might think.
Not when we stick together, it isn't.
And so, you know, at the top of the show, we were talking about reproduction and how dangerous it is for women to give birth. At least here in the United States. And you have an entire chapter in your book about reproduction. Talk to me about the flaws in the way humans procreate.
Well, there's some early flaws, meaning early in the process of reproduction, that are kind of funny to us. Number one, we have what's called concealed ovulation. So women, nor their potential mates, don't know exactly when their fertile period is. And that's very unusual in the animal kingdom. Any other species of mammal, it's very clear when a female, is fertile.
Right, so you're talking about a cat being in heat.
Yeah, exactly. Heat. Estrus cycles are what they're called in every other species, but we call them menstrual cycles because we know during the period of menstruation, but we don't know the period of fertility, right? That's different. And that's important. It has to do with our social structure, but that means reproduction is much less efficient when you don't know when the right time is to get pregnant. So, and we also take a long time to reach maturity as well. And that reduces our fertility rates by just having to wait.
Sexual maturity. As opposed to, say, a mouse.
Yeah, within a couple of weeks. And actually, mouse is a great example of this. So if you take a female mouse and you have her mate with a male mouse who is vasectomized, so there's no pregnancy, but just the mere act of copulation, she will begin being pregnant. It's called pseudopregnant. So her body goes through all the hormonal changes. She starts building a nest. She and her body think she's pregnant because that's how efficient their reproduction is. If they had sex, they will be pregnant.
Wow.
And humans, obviously not that way. But I think probably at the top of the show, you were talking about problems with delivery. And that's where we really have a problem, is that we acquired these very narrow pelvises that allowed us this upright walking with a nice striding gait. Our legs go straight down. You know, you don't have to swing your body around in order to walk. Keeps your center of gravity in the middle. Great. Well, a narrow pelvis is not great when you have a expanding cranium. So those two events happened later. So first we narrowed our pelvis, but then we started adapting this huge head, this huge cranium. And to pass through that pelvis, what did we do? Well, first of all, what you have is evolution pulling on both ends of the rope in that case, right? It's a push-pull. So what we did to try to accommodate as big a head as possible was we just moved delivery up. So our babies are born, they're not ready really to be born. Most mammals are born much more fully cooked, so to speak. If you look at a horse, when a horse just sort of falls out and starts running around, I mean, they can walk, they can move, they can eat for themselves.
I see.
Whereas humans are completely dependent for about 35 years. I'm exaggerating, but not much. But we are very, very dependent for years to come after birth.
Right, even though we have a long gestation period.
Gestation and an even longer period of dependency. And babies are kind of costly to their parents for a long time, and they have to provide for them. And so all of this reduces our efficiency, but it builds the social structure. And we got a family out of all this, right? The idea of people coming together and helping to raise the kids. I mean, some good things come of this. That's why I mean it is a happy story. But if you just look at your body and its function, there are definitely some issues there.
I'm Cindy Rodriguez, and I'm speaking with biologist Nathan Lentz about his latest book, Human Errors. So, Nathan, have we stopped evolving?
Well, we've definitely escaped the forces of natural selection, the traditional forces of natural selection. But we definitely have not stopped evolving, because anytime you have a population where you have what's called unequal reproduction, where some people reproduce more than others, then you're going to have evolution. The simplest example to prove this is birth rates are very high in some countries and very low in others. If you take Pakistan on one end of the spectrum, very high birth rates, and Japan or Italy on the other end, very low. So all we know is the next generation will have more contribution from the Pakistani gene pool and less from the Japanese one. Where that's going to take us, nobody really knows. They're not very radically different genetically, but it does mean that we are subjected to different forces of reproductive choice, because that's a new thing we have that other species don't have, is we really contemplate and make a conscious decision about whether or not we want to reproduce. And so who reproduces and who doesn't determines a little bit about the next set of gene pool. But before anyone gets too excited about anything I just said, this is one generation. It wasn't true 50 years ago. It'll be different 50 years from now. And so evolution takes much longer time scales. So who knows where we're going to be? And maybe one day we'll escape this planet and you'll have a population somewhere else who might start evolving differently than the home population back here.
So you were talking about our large craniums. So let's talk a little bit about our brains. So this is a thing that really sets humans apart. We have some of the biggest brains of all time in proportion to our body size. Mm-hmm. And we've used them to conquer all seven continents and get around the fact that we're not as fast or strong as other animals. But you have this great chapter called A Species of Suckers, where you talk about all the shortcomings of our brains. So give me some examples.
Well, our brains are really good for sizing up a situation quickly and making a snap decision. Well, that was great probably in the Pleistocene epoch, African savanna, but it's not so great now, because what it means is you have extreme reliance on a single data point, a single anecdote. So we will listen to anecdotes and believe them much more than data. And what is data except for thousands of anecdotes altogether, but yet they're not more convincing to us. So we have this tendency to rely on anecdotes. And it makes sense too, because we can identify with people. We can identify with stories. We can't identify with data, especially disembodied data. So we make very poor choices based on limited information, because we make them quickly. And then, even worse, we tend to dig our heels in, right? So once we've made a choice or we've formed an opinion, we ignore all evidence to the contrary. But again, that probably had value for us at one time. An individual who's changing his mind or apologizing a lot, it's hard to maintain high social rank or social status. And so we see that now with politicians. I mean, if they ever do apologize, right, it's always sort of mealy-mouthed and conditional and all of this. The apology is the thing you want to avoid doing at all costs, or flip-flopping.
So that's biological?
It is biological, because why else would we have such a shameful word, flip-flopping, for someone who's just changed their mind? I mean, we should be celebrating when someone changes their mind, because that means they've got more information, they've thought about it rationally, and they've come to a different conclusion than they once had. But we don't. We call them flip-floppers. We call them spineless. I mean, how much heat did John Kerry take for having changed his mind about the Iraq War? he followed the data the best he could. Now, maybe he followed political winds. I don't know. But the point is, though, that why do we have this derogatory term flip-flopping for really when we should be celebrating someone making a good choice?
What about our memories? Have they evolved?
Yeah. So we have a large capacity for memories. But what people don't realize is our memories aren't static. They're subject to editing and revision. And a lot of stories that you remember from your childhood, they didn't happen like that. And maybe you've even had a time when you remember some anecdote vividly in the first person, and then someone reminds you, oh, that wasn't you. You were there, but you weren't the subject of that story.
Right.
And it's innocent. You don't do it on purpose. You're not trying to manipulate, but you just sort of remember it differently. And this becomes extremely important in the criminal justice system, because eyewitness testimony is very powerful in a jury setting. But if the memories are bad, the evidence is bad.
Nathan, thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure.
I'm Cindy Rodriguez, and I've been speaking with biologist Nathan Lentz about his latest book, Human Errors. On August 19th at 2 p.m., Nathan Lentz will be speaking at the New York City Skeptics. On October 4th, he'll be hosting a panel at the 92nd Street Y with Carl Zimmer, Maria Konnikova, and Sebastian Sung.
Sung,
sorry about that.
Mm-hmm.